Welcome to In the News on Chris. I'm Jim McPherson, and today I'll be reading from the April 13th, 2024 edition of The Economist. On the front cover, we have a picture of a home with smoke pouring from the chimney. It's an artist's rendition of this scene, and it's on a very small piece of land that is surrounded by raging waves. The next housing disaster is the headline that goes with this particular cover, and we'll get to that, the lead story in the leader section, in a few moments. But first, let's take a look at politics this week. Japan's Prime Minister Kishida Fumio visited Washington for talks with Joe Biden and to address Congress. America and Japan are strengthening their military alliance, which includes closer cooperation between their command structures. Japan is also to join an American mission to the moon, meaning a Japanese astronaut will be the first non-American to walk on the lunar surface. America, Japan, and the Philippines then prepared for their first trilateral summit. The Philippines Coast Guard has recently clashed with Chinese vessels in the South China Sea. China's leader Xi Jinping met Ma Ying-jeou in Beijing. Mr. Ma served as president of Taiwan from 2008 to 2016, establishing friendlier ties with China. The relationship grew colder after he left office. China is trying to court friendly Taiwanese politicians while freezing out independence-minded officials, such as the incoming president, Lai Ching-te. South Korea's liberal opposition parties won the most seats in parliamentary elections, trouncing the conservative party of President Yoon Suk-yeol. The liberals fell short of a supermajority, however. In a tense phone call between Joe Biden and Benjamin Netanyahu, the American president warned the Israeli prime minister that Israel must do more to protect civilians and negotiate a ceasefire with Hamas. America's policy, Mr. Biden said, would be determined by Israel's immediate action. Israel said that it would open the Erez crossing and allow indirect shipments from Ashdod, an Israeli port, opening major new conduits for aid to Gaza. The following day saw a big increase in the number of trucks entering Gaza with humanitarian aid. Mr. Biden later offered ironclad support to Israel if Iran attacks it. Israel withdrew its ground troops from Khan Yunis, leaving just one brigade deployed in Gaza. The remaining troops will try to prevent Palestinians from leaving the south, now home to almost 90% of Gaza's 2.2 million people, and returning to the north. Ismail Haniya, the leader of Hamas, who is based in Qatar, said three of his sons were killed in Israeli strikes. Israel said that the three men were members of Hamas's military wing. Jacob Zuma, a disgraced former president of South Africa, won a court case allowing him to run for office in a general election on May 29th. Mr. Zuma had been barred by electoral officials because of a conviction for contempt of court and prison sentence of 15 months. His new party, known by its initials MK, is polling above 10% of the national vote. An overcrowded ferry capsized off Mozambique, killing at least 96 people who had been trying to flee an outbreak of cholera. Separately, at least 38 migrants, including children, died in a shipwreck off the coast of Djibouti. Zimbabwe introduced a new gold-backed currency in a bid to contain inflation after a collapse of the value of the Zimbabwean dollar, which was only reintroduced in 2019 after being scrapped during an earlier bout of hyperinflation. It said the new currency would be backed by reserves of gold and precious metals. Climate change activists won their first ever case in the European Court of Human Rights. The court ruled that Switzerland had failed to protect its citizens' rights in a case brought by a group of women in their 70s who argued that old people were particularly vulnerable to intensifying heat waves. The judges established a right to protection by the state, quote, from the serious adverse effects of climate change on lives, health, well-being, and quality of life, unquote. 46 countries are covered by the ECHR's jurisdiction. Russia and Ukraine blamed each other for drone strikes on the Zaporizhia nuclear plant, which is in Ukraine but controlled by Russian forces. It was the first time the facility had been attacked directly since November of 2022. The International Atomic Energy Agency said such attacks increased the risk of a nuclear accident and called an emergency meeting. Seven people were killed in a Russian drone strike on Kharkiv, Ukraine's second most populous city. Russia has stepped up its attacks on the city in recent months, which Ukrainian officials think may be a prelude to a new Russian incursion. Kharkiv lies just 30 kilometers, about 19 miles, from Russia. The European Union's top diplomat, Joseph Borrell, warned that Russia's ambitions to expand its reach outside Ukraine meant that a, quote, high-intensity conventional war in Europe is no longer fantasy, unquote. He described the situation as existential and said Europe may find it cannot count on America to defend it for the first time since the Cold War. A court in Russia increased the prison sentence handed down to a former aide to Alexei Navalny, the opposition leader who died in an Arctic penal colony in February. Lilia Chanyasheva ran Mr. Navalny's office in the Bashkortostan region and had been imprisoned for 7.5 years when his organization was outlawed. Her sentence has now been increased to 9.5 years after a state prosecutor asked for it to be raised. Britain, Belgium, Denmark, Germany, the Netherlands, and Norway signed a pact to cooperate on protecting underwater pipelines and other infrastructure in the North Sea. The sabotage of the Nord Stream pipeline in 2022 and damage to a pipeline in the Baltic Sea in 2023 are still unexplained. Some suspect Russian involvement, others have fingered Ukrainian agents. Iceland is to have a new prime minister. Bjarni Benediktsson, who leads the Conservative Independence Party, was chosen by the ruling coalition to lead the government, after Katrín Jakobsdóttir of the Left Green Movement resigned to run for the mostly ceremonial post of president. A scathing report into transgender health care for children was published in Britain. The CAS review recommended moving away from a model of medical intervention for trans-identifying children to one based on therapy. It also criticized the toxicity of the debate on gender for inhibiting open discussion. Mexico suspended diplomatic relations with Ecuador after Ecuadorian police stormed the Mexican embassy in Quito to arrest a former Ecuadorian vice president. Jorge Glass took refuge in the embassy last December after he faced an arrest warrant for corruption. He has already served prison time on similar charges. He says he is innocent. Mexico said it had granted him asylum. The first parents in America to be held criminally responsible for a mass shooting carried out by their child were sentenced to between 10 and 15 years in prison. Their 15-year-old boy shot dead four fellow pupils at his school in suburban Detroit in 2021. The parents were found guilty in separate trials earlier this year of involuntary manslaughter. Their son was sentenced to life in prison. Arizona's Supreme Court banned abortion in the state, reviving a law from 1864 to justify its ruling. The order was put on hold for 2 weeks, but the decision has already had political reverberations. Arizona is one of the swing states on which the presidential election in November hinges. Tens of millions of people in Canada, the United States, and Mexico turned out to watch a solar eclipse. Some of the regions where a total eclipse was viewable included parts of southern Ontario and Quebec, upstate New York, Indiana, and Texas, and Sinaloa and Durango. The event drew hordes of eclipse tourists who booked 92% of Airbnb listings within the zone of totality. Remaining in the April 13th edition of The Economist, it's on now to Business This Week. The Biden administration said that it would provide $6.6 billion in direct funding to TSMC to support its facilities in Arizona for manufacturing the world's most advanced semiconductors. TSMC, based in Taiwan, and the world's largest contract chip maker, will have three sites in Phoenix when it completes a new factory there. It is increasing its investment to $65 billion, the largest ever foreign direct investment in a greenfield project, meaning built from scratch in America. TSMC supplies chips to Apple and Nvidia for use in smartphones and artificial intelligence. Intel unveiled its Gaudi 3 chip for AI, which it claims is faster and more power efficient than Nvidia's H100. It tested the chip on two open-source language models, Llama, which is run by Meta, and Falcon, a project backed by Abu Dhabi. Intel also announced a plan to create, with other tech companies, an open platform for enterprise AI that will, quote, accelerate deployment, unquote, of secure generative AI systems. Disney is to crack down on users who share passwords to its streaming services. Bob Iger, Disney's chief executive, said the crackdown would be gradually rolled out to different countries starting in June. Netflix implemented a similar policy last year, and it has since reported a surge in subscribers. Boeing's safety record was in the spotlight again. An engineer at Boeing alleged that the company took shortcuts on quality and safety when it manufactured 787 and 777 jets, leaving them with potential structural flaws. Boeing described the claims as inaccurate. And the Federal Aviation Administration investigated yet another incident involving a Boeing plane, this time an engine panel that fell off a 737-800 during takeoff from Denver. Meanwhile, Alaska Air received $160 million in compensation from Boeing for the panel that fell off one of its aircraft in January, leaving a gaping hole in the plane. The airline said it expects further payments. Tesco, Britain's biggest supermarket chain, reported a big rise in pre-tax profit to £2.3 billion, approximately $2.9 billion, for the 12 months ending February 24th. It expects higher profits this year as inflationary pressures have, quote, lessened substantially, unquote. Meanwhile, John Lewis, a troubled department store and supermarket chain, appointed Jason Terry, a former senior executive at Tesco, as its new chair. Dame Sharon White held the position for 5 years, the shortest ever tenure in the job. The EU's General Court ruled that sanctions imposed on Mikhail Fridman, a Russian investor, and Peter Avin, his business partner, between February of 2022 and March of 2023 must be annulled. The court found that the EU had not sufficiently substantiated its reasons for linking Messrs. Fridman and Avin to Vladimir Putin's regime after Russia invaded Ukraine. Mr. Fridman is one of Russia's most prominent businessmen. Both men are still subject to sanctions not covered by the judgment. Two bits of economic data changed market calculations about the Federal Reserve's path towards interest rate cuts. America's annual inflation rate rose again to 3.5% in March from 3.2% in February. And American employers created 303,000 jobs in March, the highest number since last May, suggesting that the economy remains red hot. Stock markets sagged and the yield on government bonds jumped in response to both sets of data. Investors have narrowed their bets on when and how the Fed will cut this year, though some of those bets of up to 7 cuts were wildly optimistic. The European Central Bank left interest rates on hold, keeping the deposit facility at 4%, but indicated that it would raise rates at its next meeting in June. Many investors now think the ECB could cut rates before the Fed does. Fitch reduced its outlook for China's sovereign credit rating from stable to negative, but retained the country's A+ rating. Moody's took similar action in December. Fitch forecasts that China's central and local government debt will rise to 61.3% of GDP this year. In 2019, it was 38.5% of GDP. HSBC decided to sell its business in Argentina and will book a $1 billion pre-tax charge in its first quarter earnings related to the sale. The bank said that it would also have to acknowledge $4.9 billion in losses on its books linked to the falling value of the peso when the deal closes, though this would neither affect its financial strength nor its tangible net asset value. HSBC has been gradually pulling back from markets outside Asia in order to focus on its business there. Quote, "We'll have AI that is smarter than any one human probably around the end of next year," unquote, predicted Elon Musk in an interview. Mr. Musk's prophecy is conditioned on the continuing supply of chips and electricity. Meanwhile, Mr. Musk had more earthly matters to consider when he caused a huge political row in Brazil by calling for the resignation of a Supreme Court judge whom he suspects of ordering a block on certain right-wing accounts on his messaging service X. And now from the leaders section of the April 13, 2024 edition of The Economist, this is the article that inspired the cover, "The Next Housing Disaster. Global warming is coming for your home. Who will pay for the damage?" Think about the places vulnerable to climate change, and you might picture rice paddies in Bangladesh or low-lying islands in the Pacific. But another more surprising answer ought to be your own house. About a tenth of the world's residential property by value is under threat from global warming, including many houses that are nowhere near the coast. From tornadoes battering Midwestern American suburbs to tennis ball-sized hailstones smashing the roofs of Italian villas, the severe weather brought about by greenhouse gas emissions is shaking the foundations of the world's most important asset class. The potential costs stem from policies designed to reduce the emissions of houses as well as from climate-related damage. They are enormous. By one estimate, climate change and the fight against it could wipe out 9% of the value of the world's housing by 2050, which amounts to $25 trillion, not much less than America's annual GDP. It is a huge bill hanging over people's lives and the global financial system. And it looks destined to trigger an almighty fight over who should pay up. Homeowners are one candidate. But if you look at property markets today, they do not seem to be bearing the costs. House prices show little signs of adjusting to climate risk. In Miami, the subject of much worrying about rising sea levels, they have increased by 4/5 this decade, much more than the American average. Moreover, because the impact of climate change is still uncertain, many owners may not have known how much of a risk they are taking when they bought their homes. Yet if taxpayers cough up instead, they will bail out well-heeled owners and blunt helpful incentives to adapt to the looming threat. Apportioning the costs will be hard for governments, not least because they know voters care so much about the value of their homes. The bill has three parts: paying for repairs, investing in protection, and modifying houses to limit climate change. Insurers usually bear the costs of repairs after a storm destroys a roof or a fire guts a property. As the climate worsens and natural disasters become more frequent, home insurance is therefore getting more expensive. In places, it could become so dear as to cause house prices to fall. Some experts warn of a climate insurance bubble affecting a third of American homes. Governments must either tolerate the losses that imposes on homeowners or underwrite the risks themselves, as already happens in parts of wildfire-prone California and hurricane-prone Florida. The combined exposure of state-backed insurers of last resort in those two states has exploded from $160 billion in 2017 to $633 billion. Local politicians want to pass on the risk to the federal government, which in effect runs flood insurance today. Physical damage might be forestalled by investing in protection in properties themselves or in infrastructure. Keeping houses habitable may call for air conditioning. Few Indian homes have it, even though the country is suffering worsening heat waves. In the Netherlands, a system of dikes, ditches, and pumps keeps the country dry. Tokyo has barriers to hold back floodwaters. Funding this investment is the second challenge. Should homeowners who had no idea they were at risk have to pay for, say, concrete underpinnings for a subsidized house? Or is it right to protect them from such unexpected and unevenly distributed costs? Densely populated coastal cities, which are most in need of protection from floods, are often the crown jewels of their country's economies and societies. Just think of London, New York, or Shanghai. The last question is how to pay for domestic modifications that prevent further climate damage. Houses account for 18% of global energy-related emissions. Many are likely to need heat pumps, which work best with underfloor heating or bigger radiators, and thick insulation. Unfortunately, retrofitting homes is expensive. Asking homeowners to pay up can lead to a backlash. Last year, Germany's ruling coalition tried to ban gas boilers, only to change course when voters objected to the costs. Italy followed an alternative approach by offering extraordinarily generous and badly designed handouts to households who renovate. It has spent a staggering 219 billion euros, approximately $238 billion, or 10% of its GDP, on its Superbonus scheme. The full impact of climate change is still some way off, but the sooner policymakers can resolve these questions, the better. The evidence shows that house prices react to these risks only after disaster has struck, when it is too late for preventive investments. Inertia is therefore likely to lead to nasty surprises. Housing is too important an asset to be mispriced across the economy, not least because it is so vital to the financial system. Governments will have to do their bit. Until the 18th century, much of the Netherlands followed the principle that only nearby communities would maintain dikes, and the system was plagued by underinvestment and needless flooding as a result. Governments alone can solve such collective action problems by building infrastructure, and must do so especially around high productivity cities. Owners will need inducements to spend big sums retrofitting their homes to pollute less, which benefits everyone. At the same time, however, policymakers must be careful not to subsidize folly by offering large implicit guarantees and explicit state-backed insurance schemes. These not only pose an unacceptable risk to taxpayers, but they also weaken the incentive for people to invest in making their properties more resilient. And by suppressing insurance premiums, they do nothing to discourage people from moving to areas that are already known to be high risk today. The omens are not good, even though the stakes are so high. For decades, governments have failed to disincentivize building on floodplains. The $25 trillion bill will pose problems around the world, but doing nothing today will only make tomorrow more painful. For both governments and homeowners, the worst response to the housing conundrum would be to ignore it. Let us remain in the April 13, 2024 edition of The Economist, but let's move on to the United States section, and the lead story there runs under the headline, "Who Are the Swing Voters in America?" During his two previous presidential campaigns, Donald Trump never led general election polling averages for a single day. In 2016, he pulled within a percentage point of Hillary Clinton in July and September, but trailed in the opinion polls by 4 on Election Day. 4 years later, Joe Biden enjoyed a large, stable advantage over Mr. Trump throughout the race and ended it with an 8-point edge, according to pollsters. In both contests, such surveys sharply underestimated the support Mr. Trump received on Election Day, particularly in swing states. Today, the first former president seeking to return to office since 1912 is in the strongest position in polls of his electoral career. Mr. Trump first inched ahead of Mr. Biden, the incumbent, in national surveys last September, and has held a narrow lead for most of 2024. Our national poll tracker has them tied now, but state-level polls give Mr. Trump clear leads in 4 of the 6 states that could plausibly decide the election, Arizona, Georgia, Michigan, Nevada, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin. Even more surprising than the scale of Mr. Trump's apparent electoral renaissance is its source. Delve inside these samples of voters, and you will see that white voters' preferences have changed little since 2020. Whereas racial minority groups, long the bedrock of Democratic support, have lurched away from Mr. Biden. Mr. Trump has also cut into his successor's advantage among young voters, another core Democratic constituency, and in some surveys actually leads among people aged 18 to 29. However, standard surveys do not obtain enough data to drill down within these groups and identify the exact type of voters who, on current trends, are poised to return Mr. Trump to office. At least one source of information, thankfully, does not suffer from such limitations. Every week, YouGov, an online pollster, conducts a survey of 1,500 people for The Economist, asking a wide range of questions about religion, race, voting intentions, and political views, among other things. Since last April, the firm has obtained a total of 49,000 responses from registered voters to its question on general election voting intentions in 2024. Among them are 632 who say they backed Mr. Biden in 2020 and now support Mr. Trump, more than the standard size of an entire state-level poll. Using this rich database, we have built a statistical model of voting intentions. Based on the relationships between poll respondents' stated candidate preference and a wide range of demographic characteristics ranging from age and sex to specific states and religious affiliations, it estimates the probability that an American with any particular combination of these attributes plans to vote for Mr. Trump or Mr. Biden this year, as well as how such a person recalls having voted in 2020. As a group, swing voters are the smallest but also the most impactful, because people who flip between the two major party candidates both subtract a vote from one side and add to the other, they matter twice as much as those who switch between a candidate and not voting at all. Such voters are rare, just 3% of respondents fall into this category, but Mr. Trump is winning 2/3 of them. In today's polarized political climate, with the same nominees running in both 2020 and 2024, who could possibly change their mind? One political cliché supported by YouGov's data is that swing voters are far more focused on kitchen table issues than on the culture war subjects that animate reliable partisans. Among repeat Biden voters, the topics most often cited as most important are climate and the environment. Civil rights, abortion, and guns are also among the leaders. By contrast, Biden-Trump swing voters are most likely to list inflation as their top issue, followed by jobs and the economy. Healthcare ranks third for them and first for Trump-Biden voters, suggesting that Mr. Biden might be well advised to make defending the healthcare reform passed when he was Barack Obama's vice president a core campaign issue. The most intriguing pattern in YouGov's data, however, is probably an equally powerful factor that has nothing to do with ideology. Compared with committed partisans, swing voters are vastly more likely to have children under age 18. 47% of those flipping from Mr. Biden to Mr. Trump and 40% of those switching the other way are currently raising children, compared with 22% of repeat Biden voters and 19% of consistent Trump ones. And that's all the time we have for the April 13th issue of The Economist. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.